Hi everyone, Tia here from the I Read Comic Books podcast. This bonus mini-sode you're about to listen to is the first in a new series I'm hosting called This Is Not an Interview, in which I chat with some of my favorite people in comics about everything, nothing, and also maybe sometimes comics. It's a more casual conversation than a typical interview, and I hope you enjoy it. Oh, and one more thing. This is going to be a regular every other monthly mini-sode series. You'll hear me call it monthly in the show, but that's just because I hecked that bit up. Sorry. Okay, thanks for listening. Let's do this. This is the I Read Comic Books podcast. I'm Tia, your host for a new monthly bonus mini-sode series, This Is Not an Interview. My first guest is one of my favorite people in comics. He writes all the things, including a little book I may have mentioned once or twice on the show and everywhere, The Wicked and the Divine. Welcome back to the show, Kieran Gillen.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me here, Tia.
So I'm saying welcome back because attempts have been made. And the gremlins in the computer decided to eat our recordings, but it was a really good episode.
You should have been there. It was a hell of a thing, listener.
So
I've just read Jane Eyre, so everything I'm currently doing is basically in Charlotte Bronte's voice.
Oh, good.
Right? Read it. We recorded it and then deleted it. That's our entire approach now. Anyway.
I am definitely going to become Mr. Rochester's wife in the attic, like, pretty soon.
We all get there, you know. It's like she's kind of goals in that way.
You know,
you can work on it too.
Yeah.
So the best thing is that this is for Spangly New Thing, my book, which isn't announcing at Image Expo at the moment.
Which is going on right now.
Yeah, there's completely a heavy Bronte influence to it, so I'm reading it specifically for work, which is I didn't enjoy it at all. It's solely for the reader's pleasure. Yeah. Sorry, listen. We're also watching the Image Expo at one corner, so we're abstractly here to talk about something, but at the same time. We'll be able to occasionally yelp. We go, oh my God, did you see that? Like that.
Hey, look, this is not an interview. We're just chatting. We can talk about whatever we want and they can fight us if they don't like it.
We're not getting paid.
Okay, so we were going to talk about, and perhaps still should, because it's a great book, Four Kids Walk Into a Bank by Matt Rosenberg and Tyler Buss.
Yes, we were. The idea, after we lost this great recording, we decided we should talk about something limited so we don't talk for 2 hours again.
Right.
why did we end up suggesting Four Kids?
I don't know. I think you suggested it.
Yeah, that sounds like the sort of thing I do. I would have to actually Google and research, but as we said, we're not being paid for it. Four Kids is, I think it was just one of those situations where we said, okay, what's a book we both read and we both loved? And in my case, I've got a quote on the back.
That's right.
I said, the quote, a clear throat. I better not clear throat because it would be phlegmy and disgusting. Imagine Tarantino does Goonies, full stop. An excellent full stop. And it's a pretty good quote still. In that at least it kind of captures what the book is to some degree.
You know,
of course, when I gave the quote, it was for the first issue. So I hadn't actually read the whole book until relatively recently. So I'm glad it turned out to be a good book too, as opposed to just the first issue.
And also, you were pretty spot on with that. With that description, I would tell people Wes Anderson does Guy Ritchie.
No, that works too.
Yeah. So, you know.
It's funny because you say that. I mean, both of us have done that kind of reference. And its actual Tarantino thing is, it's quite, you know, it's original. You know what I mean? Is what's appealing about the book to me is, like, almost every panel is, for God's sake, look at me. It's like, that's what I love most about, like, Matthew's writing. It's also, I have no idea how Matthew and I completely forgot the artist's name.
Tyler Buss.
Tyler. I have no idea actually how they actually work together to create the actual paneling and that kind of choices. But in terms of, like, the amount of ideas per square inch, it's, like, so up on everything else. It's, like, so many books are, like, I'm just doing a comic. And then it's, like, no, we're going to do a comic and we're going to, like, I'm just looking at a random page and it's kind of like an Archie take on a comedy sequence. Then it's a page previously, it does, like, 9-panel grids, like a kind of Tom Taylor-y, not Tom Taylor, the other Tom, Tom King. And then previous pages doing, like, super deformed, going to a kind of almost illustrations for 4 panels, like the idea of, like, when he's doing this entire section which is basically a science experiment, then it cuts back to this the hyperacuto vision, and then it does these kind of, for me, I'm sort of giving the readers a big wide approach and I'm talking a lot, but then it does this kind of, like, what for me is the major mode, which is the entirely back flat, half the panel wasted, you know, in a traditional comic, it's like you have this full view of a character and you can see about all the heads about above them. So it's a kind of like I've completely forgot the director's name, but it's like incredibly democratic. As in, like, it's like this sense of just sitting back and seeing these kind of cut-out characters. And of course, this actually is so understated. It's such the anti-Kirby. It's completely the anti the foreshadowing. There's no sense of dynamism. It's just showing these things, and you cut down to just the iconic shapes, and it kind of suddenly makes it feel like a kid's drawing. So it's not in a kid's drawing anyway at all. There's no idea. There's a certain level of observant and ironic distance and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, I've read the book and I like it. Tina, what did you make of it?
Okay, so just so that I don't get angry tweets, not that I care because I'm kind of a jerk about it, but like full spoilers moving forward. So if you like haven't read it and you're, you know, sensitive about that sort of thing, fix your life and go read the book and then come back and finish listening, I would say is good advice.
Yes, it's good, but I've probably forgotten all the plots, so it's like I'm going to be vague and I'm going to talk about panel shapes.
Yeah, no.
And so, yeah, you can ruin people's fun.
Cool. So, like, the basic premise is there's these kids, and one of them finds out her dad is involved with these like Nazi bank robbers, and she doesn't want her dad to get in trouble. So the kids decide they're going to rob the bank instead, which is like kid logic. Kids are dumb. I don't know. Seems legit. And so they actually are pretty smart kids, except for the whole robbing a bank part. And not many people who make comics legitimately make me feel like I got punched in the face by the end of their books. You're one of those people for sure.
Thank you.
Al
I
Ewing's.
think.
Yeah, no, it's great. Like, I'll tear up if I look at Agent of Asgard. So thanks, Al Ewing. And this one, like, the ending actually, it was like all a super fun caper with the kids, but then it gets really bleak at the end, kind of.
Yeah, well, why the hell did you have to creep up with these emotions on us?
I
And
know,
it's
right?
yeah. So the thing that always makes me, if I even see the spine of I Kill Giants, I get a bit weepy. Like if I
So
still just see, like literally, it's on my bookshelf, right? I glanced at it, and I kind of that just gets to me. So yeah, I mean, it's sorry, you were gonna say the ending of how it creeps up on you.
oh, so because full spoilers, what like one of the kids accidentally gets shot, which I don't know, especially like looking back at it recently, a lot of kids are getting shot around here, and it really pulls it into like a very stark sort of. There's I get a sense of dread. I get a sense of like this happens, like kids
I mean,
get
it's like
shot.
Matthew's a really interesting political writer. You know what I mean? Political in the oh God, I'm about to become like that writer. But you know, the whole is it political derived from the Greek word from city, the polis. You know, and so first of all, of the city, as in the idea that these are the society we live in. So all writing is political, as in because it involves people and how we organise ourselves. And and Matthew is specifically that. You know, and so the way he sets up these kids and the way they live, and I'm sure I'm looking at the actual bit where he gets shot, it's played as a comedy, except it's not. The actual gunshot wound is, I mentioned those large panels.
Yeah.
There's a bit where they're tumbling, and it's almost like sex criminals for like three panels. And there's a punchline, remember, under almost no circumstances, it's okay to shoot a little kid. Next panel is this about slightly over two thirds, about between a third and two thirds of a page. And the kid's like no more than 2 centimeters. And the guy who shot him is also like 2 centimeters to his left. And the rest of the space is pretty much blank. About to the right, you've got some more people just watching. And it's incredibly austere.
Is that the one with the painting in the middle? Because I have actually some thoughts about that painting, which
Oh, that's
is,
interesting. I didn't even look at that. You're right. That's interesting. What is it?
yeah, it's George Bellows' Stag at Sharkey's from 1909. It's at the Cleveland Art Museum. And as a disgraced American art historian, my time has come.
Escaped. You're like on the run. You're like Afra.
You know what? Actually, like, I so am like Aphra, except I didn't really steal my advisor's research because, well, she's not listening, so I can just say I didn't find it that interesting. I thought mine was better. But,
Not worth stealing.
you know, but yeah, like, I should totally make people just call me Dr. Tia anyway. But, so, okay, so that there's three things about that painting because, like, someone had to choose that specific painting. They could have put any painting there. And so there's three things that strike me as important about that painting. One is that at the time, boxing matches like that were illegal in New York unless they took place at a private club. And so if a non-member of the club was participating in the fight, he was called a stag. So this is a fight with someone who is an outsider, not a member of the club. Okay, like the kids are outsiders. They're not really criminals. And then second, you know that if you look at the actual painting, it might be too pixelated in the comic, but the crowd is actually rendered really clearly, and there's someone in the crowd who's looking back at the viewer. So it makes you kind of part of the crowd. You're like in the next row.
I'm complicit.
Yeah, you're complicit. You're there. You're the audience to this fight. And then the last thing that's interesting is that the moment in the fight is... It's not a knockout punch, right? Like they're in the middle of this sort of battle that you can't tell what the outcome is going to be in the scene that Bellows chose to paint, which is also kind of true of that gunshot moment. Like, what's going to happen to the kid? I don't know. Like, this is me being an art historian nerd.
Especially the audio versus audience is like the fact that I was looking around for a tape measure because I wanted to start measuring panels.
Yeah.
This is literally what Kieran does on a Friday, on a Wednesday night. He sits at home measuring panels. I think the dimensions are the same. As in the panel that we're in is like exactly the same shape as the panel that's behind them. And of course, and the fact this is the punchline for all I've mentioned these enormous blank space panels before. This is it's such a small detail. Like the actual painting is as big as them. It's slightly smaller, but basically it's the same size.
It's and such like, an iconic American painting. If you're an American art history nerd, you're like, I know what that's doing.
It's like really, I mean, that's just fascinating. I mean, of course, over the page, when Page shoots the cop, you get the completely different. You get the kind of, who does that remind me of? I can never pronounce him, Batman Year One guy. A bit like that, the enormous lettering with him being the guy being blown up, and that's like a classic piece of comic book dynamism. We've got the letters, and you've got this like instead of like this observational, this deliberately incredibly neutral. There's a thing I do. I write a comic called Uber Listener, and one of my standard things, and I do it in Wicked a little, but Uber is the primary device. I use three panel tiers with set camera angle, and I do just sitting there. The reader sits and watch something happen, and it's basically normally something horrible. But it's also like quite often just the idea that we are like a shitty camera crew watching. Like there's no moving camera. You're just sitting in. So the idea of like having a boring angle reduces dynamism and tries to like get the verisimilitude. The idea of holding the moment and just that's the kind of thing with Uber. Uber's quite deliberately boring, as in boring as an aesthetic. You know, because melodrama is not really the point of it. And the same as this moment where, and you know, they've undercut it and they play it out. And then they push it up and they go for something that's much more dynamic, something that's much more a traditional classic comic book.
I think I know what you're talking about. When I try to describe that, I think I say something's aestheticized or not aestheticized. So yeah, that makes perfect sense to me.
How it goes up and down I tell you the thing that, I don't know about you agree with me, it's Tia. This is one of the few books I've read that felt, there's a lot of books, not a lot. Some books have tried to be post-Hawkeye. And this is one of the few, I think, has at least in some way tried to be post-Sex Criminals. Obviously, it's working on a completely different emotional train. And there's a little bit of Hawkeye. I mean, I look again, there's more Hawkeye to it.
Yeah.
But the idea of, like, you can... The level of... Irony is such a loaded word in that kind of it's been worn thin. But the idea of how you actually can use irony as an effect to get something that's much more, you know, as a device to heighten emotions. It's like a masterclass. And that's the thing, you know, Matthew's a smart writer. That's why I'm wondering about how him and Tyler works in terms of like their previous work they did together. I've completely forgot his name for a second. What's it called?
Oh.
That were...
Not We Can Never Go Home?
Yeah, We Can Never Go Home. Was that them? Was that Tyler as well?
I don't think it was I don't think it was Tyler.
No, I mean, I'm wrong. But... But he's also good. But yeah, I mean, like, this idea of, like, I mean, Matthew is at least a script he writes, a comic purist scripts. You know, like, he's when I say comic purist, I mean, he's somebody who's interested in the medium. Mm-hmm. And very specifically a voice in creating the medium. I don't know, I find him, like, really, very genuinely one of the most interesting and awkward writers. As in, I find his awkwardness interesting.
Well, sorry, go ahead.
No, I stopped.
There are some pages where they do like the big splash diagrammy type thing that gives me a lot of Young Avengers feelings.
Mm-hmm. Maybe. I mean, that's what I think. I mean, so I think he might. He's awkward. There are definitely bits I can see. I wouldn't say influenced by me and Jamie, but like coming from a similar place. And of course, there are all certainly creators I would completely say, right, with me and Jamie have influenced.
Well, you're actually, kind of a big deal.
Thank you very much. You're famously a big deal. No, I said, like, I would say that, and I wouldn't, actually, I'm lying, I wouldn't say that. I would say that to you in a pub, in a kind of like, I see what they're doing. As opposed to when I read Matt's stuff, no, I think Matt's coming from a similar place. You know what I mean? As in, like, I feel, you know, as in somebody who's part of the conversation rather than just aping the conversation.
This actually, I feel like we talked about this in the Lost Gillen tapes, the idea of influence versus inspiration.
Mm.
We did talk about that.
I think we talked about it a lot, though. It's like That's 2 hours of deleted. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, but I think that's it's a really interesting, because the thing that Four Kids gets me is just the confidence. It's the idea of, I can't believe a Marvel or a DC editor wouldn't pick it up and go, oh yeah, we need to give this guy work.
I know, right?
You know, it's that kind of, it's like, no, he's clearly ready. He knows what he wants to do the medium. He's working in a variety of modes. You know, and you can sort of tell by the work that Matthew's got, and the fact this is crime with a quirky edge and but also emotional heart. A lot of the work he's got has kind of come from that. And I'm not sure if it's because he's pitching it or because people are approaching him because of it. It's like, and it's also so personal. I mean, okay, I'm lying. I've never talked to Matthew about this.
Matthew, but it seems personal.
Yeah. We should phone him. I feel bad because I don't know Tyler as well, I think. But I do know, you know, Matthew, obviously.
Yeah, I think I might have met him at a convention or something, but not beyond just saying, hey, I love your book. Oh, one other thing. So if we're talking about references and influences and things, in the very last couple of pages, when Paige gets out of jail, what t-shirt is she wearing? Oh, goth one.
Let me check. Oh my God, what is that? It's
The sky's gone out. So my theory is that you're supposed to put on All We Ever Wanted Was Everything as you read the last pages.
I can see that.
Yeah.
I do like the black page with Later on, which is...
Right.
Yeah, and the fake ending and the... I do like the not easy, easy ending. As you know, you completely could have just ended it with just kids and left it open.
Right.
I think, you know, he chose to resolve in a different way, which I find that's all... You know, that's kind of... It's like, where do you choose to end the story? Says anything about the story.
And it's, like, kind of bleak.
Yeah.
And it's, which you I know, love.
It's sad. I mean, yeah. It's sad in a meaningful adult way, as in like, oh yeah, and they went to prison, you know.
Yeah, and so I feel like the tone of the whole book before that is very cute, and you know, you get all the like Stranger Things nostalgia feels if that's your deal, and you know, the opening of all of the issues where the kids are talking in their like nerdy avatars. There's the D&D one, and then they have their video games and their RC toys, and the last one is, I don't know, just their like their dolls, their toys, their analog toys. And so the everything leading up to that is the like fun, grand, dangerous kid adventure, you know, which is like exhilarating, and everything's gonna be fine because that's how those stories end.
Yeah, I mean, even up to the point where the character's about to get shot, because he's the slightly annoying character.
He is.
He's like, I'm trying to work out the archetype if people haven't read the book. The cliche is he's slightly fatter than they are. Like, that's the sort of thing I would pick up in terms of, like, I know he's leading into archetypes, but, like, that he's the archetypal that kid. And it's a comedy scene. He's wearing fucking breeze blocks on his feet, wearing a Batman outfit, and he jumps the guy from behind, and it's a stupid wrestling. It's like wrestle, 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 and it's, you know, it's dumb. You know, it's deliberate. You know, I mean dumb in that it's the, you know, if you see this in the movie, it's like Home Alone. It's right. Like the kid's just jumped on the back, and he's wearing a costume. And he's, you know, it's probably a funny soundtrack, and then he just gets shot through the gut.
Yep. And then you're like, what the fuck?
Yeah. I mean, it's like I think it's. I think we're in danger of like over-worrying the back tier. Do you think we're like over-concentrating the back end because it's also the journey?
A bit, maybe. I don't know. I told you I'm bad at talking about the plot. I mostly just want to talk about like the cool design and aesthetic and art and all of that sort of thing. And you're the writer.
That's what I mean. Oh no, that's what I mean. I'm agreeing with you, but basically like, the fact we're doing the kind of the awful, as in how they made us cry at, you know, the end.
Yeah.
We're like, the really, I'm just literally every I can't even exaggerate. Every page, they're doing something clever.
No, it's so good.
Yeah. I mean, so, I've just opened... Literally, I've opened the... Open a random... Do you have it with you?
Digital.
It's like, if you open a random page, it's like... Page goes, now Berger. And then we suddenly cut to, like... Looks like about 20th of a page panels.
Oh, like, yeah.
Yeah. The preferred tool of the unrepentantly obnoxious, as in a tiny bit of, you know, a close-up of a catapult. A close-up of a tiny toy from they've got from the D&D game, labelled the son of groin the most. Then another close-up of the eye of a grown-ass man who punches little girls. Then the fourth panel in the row is just the letters GA in enormous letters. The next panel, you actually pull back out and you see the fact they're just, you know, the guy's on the floor. So by obviously, by implication, like one of the kids has just shot him.
I love that, though. It forces you to read it with such a fast pace that you can almost picture what that would be like in a film with like the quick cuts in it. I don't know. Yeah,
it's so snappy.
Yeah, it is. I don't know. So did you ever have any sort of dangerous childhood adventures that, like, I mean, maybe not, maybe not bank robbing. Clearly, you lived through them. If you did,
well, if I can't possibly tell my dangerous childhood in Stafford, where I would, of course. Let me think. I was a weirdly nice kid. Like, I think back to my childhood. My main thing is I always think about why wasn't I bullied more, and I can't quite work out why I never attracted bullies' attention. Because I was literally lived inside of my own head. I was like. But I was like, it's a weirdly aggressive geek. I mean, aggressive in terms of like shameless.
Yeah.
Like I was like, I was incredibly out.
Like they couldn't, like, how could they bully you about that if you were, you'd just be like, whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Jedi are amazing. Don't you understand?
Exactly. Same. No, never. I was not bullied. In fact, The closest anyone ever came to bullying me was there was this like petition that they passed around saying that I was a witch and I should not be allowed at school because I was a witch.
Well, to be fair, that is true.
I know, exactly.
I would understand that worry.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's like the Spanish new thing I'm working on, at least is some degree mining my teenage stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So at least some of it I've essentially have to tear apart and try to work out what was really going on there. But yeah, I mean, it's like, some of the stuff is just not, like, my God, that was a bad young person thing to do. But
how was I not kidnapped and murdered?
Yes, this is foolish and stupid. And also ways you, like, before I had full emotional competence, ways I'd hurt people. I can certainly remember my, I remember people, it's like, how awful shit people going around on me in terms of that thing. I think literally anything really genuinely terrible I did as a teenager, which was illegal and could possibly make an interesting novel. Not sufficient.
Yeah.
I didn't shoot anyone. It's harder in the UK.
Didn't shoot anyone, yeah. I mean, I live in Gun Central, but I'm a good shot if I have to, but like...
Really?
Yeah, my brother was a shooting instructor. He was in the Marines.
That's good. I always try to remember all my friends who, their skills.
Yeah.
If there's ever a zombie apocalypse, I know who to call.
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty far away, but if it's like at a con or something, you know.
It's like in every town I need my crew. It's
yeah.
at Christmas, for a few years, I used to run a role-playing game. When that kind of period at university, they come back for Christmas to family, that kind of thing. And anyone who's in town, I ran an RPG for, and it was normally a you play yourself game. Mm-hmm. So you translate your character, your real life abilities into the game, and then I throw them for a zombie apocalypse. Which led to the one thing that playing my brother Pam was an ordained Catholic lay person, which means he can bless holy water.
Ooh, handy.
So in a moment, he genuinely handy in a zombie apocalypse. So that kind of thing was useful.
Yeah.
Anyway.
No, I actually have always been like very bitter ever since I saw The Professional that I wasn't some sort of like child spy or assassin of some kind.
So yeah, I'm genuinely not surprised by any of this. This is like, yes, that sounds like Tia's origin.
Yeah. You know, I'm still waiting for the Red Room to give me a call.
Are you aware it's the ballet training? So you went to do the ballet and you're hoping you were gonna picked up to be an assassin. Makes so much more sense. Are you aware of I'm not sure why I'm doing an RPG focus. Are you aware of the game Tales from the Loop?
No.
Tales from the Loop, listeners may be interested in this, is an RPG that came out last year or the year before. And it's based around, there's an artist whose name I forget, who does this, you've almost certainly seen them forwarded on the internet, these hyper-real portraits of like an imaginary 1980s. So it's like kids playing in a field in Norway, and there's a giant robot in the background, and they're not really noticing it.
Okay, yes, that sounds familiar.
Oh yeah. Matthew has just gone on stage. Is Matthew announcing a book? This is amazingly timed!
Okay, hold.
Hold, I'll come back to Tales from the Loop, because it is genuinely relevant. Rosenberg and Boss, they look happy. Rosenberg, he's dressed up like Dennis the Menace, the British Dennis the Menace, not the American one, who is fascinating guy. I haven't got the sound on, so I've got no idea what he's announcing.
Is there a cool like PowerPoint presentation going on, or like a trailer?
No, he's holding some milk. You know, Hershey's in a milk bottle.
Oh yeah, you don't know about that?
No, is that a thing?
He's like obsessed with Yoo-hoo, which I don't think is like legally milk.
Okay. Is it legally edible?
It's shelf stable.
Oh, shelf stable. It will survive us all.
In the zombie apocalypse, find Matthew Rosenberg. He will have Yoo-hoo.
That sounds literally amazing. I'm going to keep one eye on it and see if he actually announces the book, because this literally would be perfect.
That's,
I was generally thinking, why isn't Matt doing it? I was thinking, why isn't Matt doing an image book? And like for this conversation, in that kind of like, Matt is completely somebody who should be doing an image book right now.
Maybe but we like conjured this somehow.
We have powers, Tia. We have powers.
You know, that petition, I'm telling you.
Tales from the Loop is basically about, and they took this game, these portraits, and made an entire RPG world around it. And the idea being a weird 1980s, and it basically is Stranger Things, the RPG. So you end up playing these archetypal kids, and you go for adventures in the countryside to work out what's going on. So it's like random, like I just did a streaming game, and the plot was basically weird, a new form of Transformers was released, and they ended up being like evil killer Transformers, and we had to hunt down why these two these toys were killing each other and taking over our parents' brains. You know what I mean? So that kind of plot, so it's that kind of, you know the archetypes, you know that sort of structure. But the thing about actually playing that game, this is kind of partially why 4Kids from the Bank worked, as you mentioned earlier, is that you play these characters and immediately, A, they're really interesting archetypes to play. Like if you're playing like the computer geek or the popular girl or like the hick or all these different characters, you've got an angle and you can attack it. And in other words, you can actually play them, and it's not like I'm playing a warrior. You know, but a warrior is a tedious archetype. You know, the nerd with the heart of gold or whatever. That's an archetype that actually you get. And at the same time, we're playing like kids. They're all like 11 to 16 in the game. No, sorry, 11 to 15, 10 to 15. You can play with an emotional hand, which is open in a way you can't necessarily when playing a 25-year-old. Like, there's awareness of like, because most people who've played the game have been that age. In fact, specifically, it's mainly played by older people. You can at least tap back to, oh no, I was my emotions were near the surface and I acted in ways which were, you know, frankly stupid. But now, you know, because I was dealing with these emotions for the first time. And that's the kind of, that's A, the genius of the game, and B, the genius of doing something like 4Kids walk into a bank, in that he's kind of like mashing, you know, they're mashing, they've got the strength of that, being able to look at these characters who don't self-censor as much.
Mm-hmm.
And this was for me, like when I started writing Kid Loki, that was kind of a breakthrough in that my characters are cold, and most of my characters are about like how they hide their emotions and they don't express stuff, you know, and specifically it's about the mask and how they are censoring and they don't let stuff out.
Mm-hmm.
And when they let it out, it's a big deal, which of course makes it kind of hard for a lot of people to care. Whilst Kid Loki was this very weird thing for me, because it was like the fact he is 13 means, oh yeah, he's still a genius, he's still trying to manipulate people and he's brilliant, but my god, he's very upset about his dog. Or like occasionally, you know, the ability of it getting too much for him, his threshold of that is too much for me is lower, and that made me wear my heart on my sleeve more.
Yeah,
and that's kind of the breakthrough. People A, like that, and B, it works. You know, for drama, it works much better. And you can't just have these kind of glacial creatures as much as, you know.
It's boring because like you have to be like that in real life. So what's the point of the fiction?
This is one of the things in RPG. I mean, I can't believe I'm talking about RPGs so much at the moment. Sorry, Tia.
No, it's okay.
But I'm thinking about in terms of narrative structure, in that the classic era is somebody would create a character and they're the cool loner. And the mm-hmm. cool loner is terrible. You know, like, because it's like, that literally is a dead end story. Because the entire point of cool loners in fiction is like Han Solo. The point of Han Solo is he's very easily talked into doing stuff.
No,
as in he pretends for a whole second not to be into it, and then he gets lured back into it. But if you actually play, if you're trying to pretend to be the cool loner, by definition, you're like an anchor. And for me, like, I accidentally, in a game of Tales from the Loop, created a character who was kind of deliberately antisocial and didn't want to go out, and he's a very hardcore, like, computer geek. Mm-hmm. And I realised that I fucked up, this character's going to destroy the game because he doesn't want to play. And so I made it about the day. I want to start a club. As I said, so it's the moment when this, you know, it's about somebody who is very antisocial trying to deal with the fact they're trying to be social. And that is what stories are about. It's when people, stories about the fracture lines.
Yeah, exactly. That makes sense. Also, Han Solo got... Ooh, what?
Sorry, Dead Guy Fan Club by Annie Wu. Annie Wu's just come on stage. I've got no idea what this is. It looks amazing.
Yes, anything Annie Wu, I'm sold.
Oh, man. I forgot I'd worked with Annie once. It was terrible. She did the Young Avengers strip.
Oh.
Which I forgot about. The reason why, because that whole issue was done when my dad was dying. So that whole thing is kind of like sort of edited out.
Right.
But we did a Bjork trip together for the Femme Fatale book.
I have that.
Thank you.
It's wonderful. Yeah, it's beautiful.
I haven't got a copy of it yet. I need to actually... my copy's waiting for me somewhere. but I'm excited to read it all, basically.
No, it's great. Actually, one of my students is doing a solo to a remix of Headphones. And she's she'd never heard of Bjork before. She's very sheltered. So this has opened up a whole new world for her. I brought it in for her to look at. And she's like really into it. She's like, the weirder, the better when it comes to Bjork for this kid. I love it.
That's all right. I mean, I love that. It's like, it's not about you, Tia, because you're significantly younger than I am. But my favorite thing about being old is that kind of like people getting to see people discover stuff.
Yeah.
It's that kind of like, I don't know, as a critic, so like, read this. This is awesome. Well, you might like
I love foisting music upon my students, and they just think, apparently they have like a whole chat thread about how weird my music is, and I'm like, I'm fine with that, because then the other soloist chose Bela Lugosi's Dead for her solo, and she's 12, so my work here is done.
I must say, Tia, that sounds, I would say it doesn't sound like you, but no, that really, really does sound like you.
I mean, her dad showed up to our recital in a Chewbacca costume, so it maybe wasn't all me.
This honestly sounds like a novel. Like, this is actually a Matthew Rosenberg. The book, we missed the name of this book, but this is Matthew Rosenberg, the kind of like the goth ballet teacher doing the thing, and the parents go, this is a heartwarming family movie about triumph over adversity. I want to watch this.
No, last year they were Sith Lords. We did the Imperial March for their competition. I don't know why we're talking about me now. How's Star Wars?
It's a conversation, not an interview. That's true. I believe as we foreshadowed.
Okay, fair.
Star Wars is fine. I'd say my favorite thing about writing Star Wars is it's the first book that I've done in my comics career that I generally get young people for, as in not like teenagers. There's quite a lot of my books that have quite a big teenage readership.
Yes,
but actual like tiny humans, and it's quite, you know, and that's genuinely fun in terms of like, okay, I must not swear, and I must not be too weird. But that kind of like, you know, you can really genuinely connect people. And it's also my nephews-in-law, they're very into Star Wars and they're excited by the fact that I even exist.
Right. Which is quite fun. No, you have to put a little swearing in, or else how are they going to learn?
You need to learn like Star Wars swear words. Like, that's the thing. It's like,
in like a Wookiee language or something.
Yeah. I tell you, the worst thing is, can you do a good Wookiee impression?
I cannot.
I can't. That's my weakness. No. It's like... I worry about my Wookiee dialogue not being good enough because I can't actually verbalize Wookiee.
Did you see on the internet someone speculated that Black Kersantan is the Black Wookiee in the Han Solo footage?
I imagine so. I deliberately watch very little of the footage that leaks online.
Yeah.
And I try to unavoid, but it's like, kind of, because I'm a fan as well. So the stuff which I need to know is fed to me. It's the best way of putting it.
Yeah, that makes sense. My students are all obsessed with Star Wars, and in fact, I was invited to one of their houses for Christmas Eve, and one of them had a like, well, actually, nerd uncle, who kept trying to like engage me in a who knows more about Star Wars comics conversation, which was very fun.
I don't get it. It's like. It's one of those weird sorts of behavior that doesn't make any sense. I mean, as a bloke, it genuinely makes no sense to me.
yeah, I don't know, but you're You strike me as the kind of person who finds it easy to talk to pretty much anybody.
Well, talk at is like.
But those of us who don't have that really appreciate the people who talk at us, and so to prevent us from saying dumb shit if we're left to fill the air with talking.
I've probably said this to you before, Tia, but then me and Jamie define our relationship, because Jamie doesn't really like people or talking to them. But that kind of the I'm Jabba the Hutt and he's Salacious Crumb. Because I have no memory for faces or names or places, or like I basically spend my life kind of confused by existence. And Jamie tells me people who Jamie is like the Gary in Veep, as in he's kind of my bag man and whispers stuff to me.
Yeah,
and I do all the heavy lifting because he's very good. Obviously, Jamie is very good at faces and names, and I'm willing to do the talking. But it's like we kind of form one almost functional human being between us.
Have you ever seen this little comic strip where someone pets a cat with their foot and the cat looks outraged and it says, "Did you just pet me with your foot?" And then a dog comes running from behind the corridor and goes, "Did I hear something about foot petting?" And it just... It reminds me of a conversation that we had where we established that you were the puppy and Jamie was the cat of the duo.
Like, I'm like, I think that is pretty true.
I think the best conversation I've ever had with Jamie was about cats.
Yeah. Oh, this is probably over. Imagine Jamie listening to this and go, Kieran! the thing is, like, Jamie, like many good-looking people, like, people presume good-looking people who are shy are rude.
Right.
So quite often, like, especially like when Jamie was younger and better looking, I say pointedly, Jamie. You know, as in people quite often thought Jamie found Jamie quite standoffish, and people, and that's that interesting because people, that's how our insecurities work. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's like if you assume that somebody must have more social standing than you due to their appearance, and they treat you badly, you must presume that's because of you rather than because of them. And that's what, like, this is one of the things I find really interesting. And I, of course, don't have that because, you know, I'm not being down on myself. I'm classically less good looking than Jamie. That's, you know, that's just a natural, that's, you know, on social levels, that's fine.
Yeah, it's rough because you can't just cover it up with a lot of red lipstick like I can.
Yeah. It's like, you know, I just wear a lot of black and sneer. I got by.
I have a closet full of sparkly party dresses and you just like dazzle them. I just bought hot pink sequin socks.
Yeah, that's good.
You know, like I feel like I have exhausted the sparkling party dress options. So I've moved on to socks.
I do like throwing on suits and my shiny shoes for the week of announcements were a joy. Sorry, the whole point of that story was not that Kieran Gillen is ugly, but that kind of like how people pass rudeness and like different levels of like stuff like that. I find it very, especially in comic circles where everyone is like twitchy is a good way of putting it, I think.
Yeah. As
in, like, people are quite often, I mean, I'm not naturally outgoing. You know, I'm like, I always remember my dad, and my dad was specifically, he was always very much like me in public, but the second he kind of like closes, you know, there's a closing down when you get home, not in a bad way, but in a kind of like way. One of my friends who's a cartoonist, and we were heading out of a bar together at a con, and I kept heading for the con, and of course I know a lot of people, and I'm, you know, doing the hand wavy hello, etc. Right. thing. And at second I go out, she hears me sigh hard. And but you know, and it mentions that kind of like kid. You know, I had no idea you were like, you didn't enjoy it. You know, that kind of like the, and people don't often, when people are on, you don't often see them drop the guard.
Yeah.
I guess. It's more that I am capable of, I'm willing of faking stuff. And it's not this, sorry, not faking, but I'm willing to put on performance of being, okay, how to phrase this. Tia, it's the kind of the social equivalent of putting on red lipstick, I guess.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Yeah. I can do it like every 3 months for a weekend at a con, and then I need 3 months to recover for the next one.
Mm.
Pretty much.
It's pretty hard.
I mean, it could be worse. The big art history conference is going on right now, and I'm just like, haha, suckers.
Mwahaha.
Yeah, mine are more fun now. Yeah, I don't know. I do not think of myself as a people person. I don't feel like I ever come off well in conversations. Like I just beat myself up all the time after I talk to people. But I mean,
you've said many dumb things during this conversation. I would be ashamed of everything. Yeah, exactly. Like that is completely it, isn't it?
I kind of just like keep doing it anyway and figure that people will avoid me if they get tired of me.
Yeah.
Which is really hard to put, to like force myself into that mindset, because I would rather just be Mr. Rochester's wife in the attic.
Your gothic goals await. But this is then. It's like, I mean, I think almost everybody, I used to be in gym. I remember me and Jim talking about this. I think one of the major things that keeps society together is embarrassment more than many other negative emotions. As in, I think about things I did like into my early teenage years. In fact, even younger, there's stuff I did, something I said when I was 5. I'm still so shockingly embarrassed about how I eat a pillow. You know what I mean? And I think I don't think that's unusual in any way. And like the idea of, oh no, that was shameful in a way that I'm like, I cannot articulate. It's funny. It's like some stuff I've said in therapy that which is much more abstractly disturbing, but like, but there's certain, like in terms of very shallow, like dumb shit you said as a kid to somebody, like, no, that I still don't want to, you know, ejaculate that in anyone's direction.
You're like, well, I guess I can never speak to that person again, ever.
That means I have to change my species and become an ant. I'm moving with the ants, and I'm an ant now. That's what we do.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, I guess, look, we've been talking now for like 45 minutes, and you haven't hung up on me.
It's very strange. No, strange. It's like, you know, too, you're not somebody I would ever pass as being, like, there's people you, especially the fact that I do most of the talking on a Wicked table. Like, when people come to the table, you're always trying to identify how is this person, what are they here for, what do they want? How can you be the person you need to be for them, or they need you to be? And I like, we don't, okay, we're not like someone like, I don't know, Gerard Way, who deals with crying people like constantly,
right?
But we have enough people who are like in tears that we have a kind of not a drill for crying people, but like an awareness of like how we can make this easier for them and get them through, and you know, that like we don't freak out when people cry,
yeah,
and that kind of like, you know, so that when I'm saying the whole spectrum of like people are just a bit awkward and be friendly and make it cool for them, and people are genuinely having a hard time. You're not somebody I ever passed as like socially awkward.
I'm glad you have a selective memory.
Well, you never burst into tears when I met you.
No, but I'm not really a crier. I did not cry in emotion. I Kill Giants when I read I Kill Giants. I'm kind of a monster. I don't know.
You're stronger than I think.
but I did cry at the end of Agent of Asgard when Loki forgives himself and hugs himself.
That's pretty good. Actually, yes. What else do you cry at? I cry at We Three. Actually, this is, you're talking about being a dog person. Mm-hmm. The bit at We Three where the scientist grabs the dog and says, "Your name is Bandit. Run far," and then she gets shot through. But your name is Bandit. Run far. Honestly, I'm kind of tearing up a bit as I say that right now.
Do you want to hear something super dumb that makes me cry? That makes no sense because I literally hate everything else about it.
No, definitely. That's the best time for tears.
Yeah. Okay. The Waltz of the Snowflakes in the Nutcracker, the song, makes me cry every time. It's so perfect. Like it is. So, if you played that song to someone who has never heard of snow, they would know exactly what snow is.
That's like one of my favorite words, which I learned around, you know, like obviously numinous is an amazing word.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of like just like the idea, oh, the kind of the fear of the divine, the fear of art, and the idea of something can be so perfect, it's kind of upsetting.
Yeah.
You know, that gets beneath my skin. I mean, obviously that's in Wicked and that's in all the work I do. But the idea of that, yeah, there's definitely that kind of like, when art is too much, that's an interesting, I suppose, feeling every emotion at the same time is hard to deal with.
Yeah,
I guess.
Yeah, no, it's true, especially when it's like kind of going back to what we were talking about with the archetypes and making characters younger so they can have their feelings a little more on the surface. I think that in most adult scenarios, you're expected to be very, you know, you're supposed to like keep your emotions in check. They're not really appropriate for people to know about. And I mean, you could internalize that in ways that makes it hard to, it's where it's like either on or off, you know.
Mm. It's hard. I mean, like, no, this, I'm better than I used to be at this shit, but certainly it's all a process. We've gone well off comics, haven't we? We did actually mention comics recently.
Tears,
emotional wreck podcast. What we talk about is how we're not very good at being human.
I suspected that we would get off topic. But you know,
that's,
I did
good.
I had notes also.
The topic is us.
It's true. This isn't an interview. We're just chatting about stuff.
Just chilling.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm probably going to get kicked out of my recording room in about 2 minutes.
Yes, yeah, so I was looking at the time too. We should, do we end with a song or just...
why don't we end with your favorite thing that ever made you cry?
Wow. Oh my God.
2 minutes, go.
Actually, this is quite the same joke. Oh my God, actually this is the line I put in Phonogram for Mark Allaby.
Oh man, we didn't even talk about Phonogram. Damn it.
Literally, like one of the first things I said, when I met Mark Allaby, a British cartoonist, I've worked with a couple of times. He's amazing. He's currently mainly doing Rick and Morty stuff. We met at like pretty much the first thought bubble. And one of the first things I said to him was, Mark Allaby, what's the favourite time you've ever cried? And that kind of like, but it's like, in part, he's very emo. And I put that line into the girl in the second episode of Singles Club. As in, Mark Allaby, what's the favourite time you ever cry? Rubbing her eyes softly. So, yeah, that was one of those bits. Like, I do like the idea of like him having a top 10 cry list.
Yeah.
He's grown now as a human, though. He doesn't have a top 10 cry list, only top 5.
Oh, you become dead inside it by increments, so.
Do you think any time I've actually cried, my brain's gone blank. This is literally...
Isn't that the worst? That happened... I mean, I'm not a crier. I'm really not a crier. It's so, yeah.
I want to tell you the funny. I cried. I started bursting to tear. Burst into tears randomly. While watching. I came in and Chrissy was watching, I think, Legally Blonde 2. Or maybe Legally Blonde.
Mm-hmm.
And Legal Blonde lady was talking to the lady who runs the hair salon about just before she was about to go into the. And she's doing a speech about something. And it's like, and then I turned to Chrissy and I go, I'm crying, I have no idea.
Look, that's an excellent movie, okay?
No, it's great, it's a great movie. But literally, I just walked in having, like, out of context, it's a big speech between her and a kind of quasi-mentor figure. And right. I've got tears running. I've literally walked in with a cup of tea and I've got tears running my face instantly. It's a mess.
Have you read Anne of Green Gables?
I not know.
Oh, you gotta get into
it. I'm aware of the Green Gables and the Anne.
So I won't, okay, then I'm not going to spoil you. Read it, that's okay. One. Okay. I think we got to wrap it up. I think they're going to kick me out of here. I mean, unless you want me to just wander around the office with the mic, that we could do that.
It's like, we've done it. We should do it again with a different book and a different Image Expo. We can actually generally get together and talk about Image Expo.
Okay.
And other topics of emotional dysfunction and whatever, or like actually trying to be a functioning human being in this world. Is
Let's figure it out.
We'll get this sorted. Okay. You know, it can't be that hard.
Stick with us, kids.
Yeah. It's like, someone's going to rise and explain. I'm going to explain your issues have been demonstrated entirely in this podcast. Rhyming typing. Anyway, see ya. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. And do you want to give a plug to your Twitter, your podcast, anything that you want our listeners to check out?
My name's Kieran Gillen. You can find me on the name KIERONGILLEN. Enter that into Google, you'll find it everywhere. I am doing various comics, none of which require a plug, because they all do quite well. I tell you, I'm editing 24 panels, which is basically a charity anthology in aid of trauma support for the survivors of the, amongst others, the survivors of the Grenfell Tower disaster in the UK. So I'm in the position of like, it's open submissions from like people, with like newcomers. I'm talking for people, and it'll be, I think it's probably September, October, but I'm putting that together at the moment, and I'm working with a group and a trauma charity. So that's kind of like the thing I'm doing at the moment. So I'm raising awareness of that now. So please, people, order it when it actually becomes available. That's a very serious end to an actual fairly frivolous podcast.
Oh, well, we were talking about really emotional things, so I don't know. It's okay. It's all good. We're going to figure it out. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, too.
We'll see you around.
Bye.
Bye.
Follow us on Twitter at IRCB Podcast, and you can follow me on Twitter at Portrait of Madam X. We have a Goodreads group where we're over 300 members strong, and we have weekly threads, monthly show discussions, all kinds of stuff. Our website is IRCBpodcast.com. Please rate the show, subscribe, and tell your friends. You can email the show at IRCB@destroythesybe.org. Infinity Shred is the best. They do all our music, Xander is also the best. He edits the show. And of course, Mike is also the best. He's our podcast producer extraordinaire. Thank you to them. Thank you to you. Thank you to my guests. Thank you.